Church, I am believing that God believes we can have hearts shaped to be more like His this fall. Paul offers us this motivating picture of just what that can look like in this passage I want to read for you now from Galatians chapter 5. By contrast, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. There is no law against such things. Well, Paul uses that phrase, if you'll notice, he puts fruit in the singular, like we've been talking about. He puts fruit in the singular. And so how I'm understanding that is what he means is the fruit, the goal, the source, the object is love. And the rest of those things are descriptions of what love can look like. He's not attempting here to give this comprehensive picture of what the fruit of God's Spirit would look like, but simply giving some specifics for a group of people at a given time. This fall in our series, what we're going to be doing is pulling out one of those descriptive words that describes what love looks like, zeroing in on it, and digging around to figure out what it means for our lives today. Today, I get the fun one, joy. Or is it? It does seem that joy is elusive today. In North America, many of us have what centuries of generations of people have said, we have what they said was going to bring joy. We have a material excess that it was something unfathomable for even a few generations back. We have entertainment that is like an avalanche unending coming at us. Yet, we are experiencing levels of depression, levels of anxiety, and suicide rates that far outpace previous generations. What the world said would bring us joy hasn't. And it does seem that the chief hallmark of our era is our polarization. We have everything that people have said is going to bring us joy, and yet we don't seem to be able to even get along with people that have different perspectives on lives than we do, let alone be filled with joy. Part of the understanding of this little puzzle lies right here in Paul's analogy. Joy is a fruit. Joy is a fruit. He calls it fruit very much so on purpose. Fruit is a consequence, so to speak. Fruit is a result of an internal process of a plant that produces something. We've been trained to think that joy is going to come to us from the outside. If we get the right possessions, if we get the right prestige, if we have enough power, those are all external things coming to us. What Paul is describing is that fruit, if you want fruit, the fruit of joy, then you got to deal with the root. Fruit is an issue of roots. How is the internal process coming together? Well, you would then naturally ask, what is the process? I want joy. What's the process? Well, church, you already know. And I'm going to tell you again anyway. Because it's what I do. And it's because every single one of us needs to be reminded on a regular basis of the good news of the gospel that Jesus came announcing. He didn't come hoping for it. And he didn't come looking for it. He came announcing it. The kingdom of God is at hand. which is the good news. The kingdom of God is at hand. He came announcing that this was true, and he came demonstrating the process, and it's what we want to dig into here today. I want to show it to you in Paul's life, because he gave us those words. I want to show it to you in Jesus' teaching, and I want to show it to you in Luke's time with Yoda. All of this that I learned from a paradigm through a Franciscan priest, and it's quite a ride. I believe the true ride that joy takes. It all starts here in order. This is the first part of life, the part of life where there is an innocence and a safety. How Genesis 1 and 2 speak of our time in the garden. Each one of us, by the grace of God, and not everybody experiences order. Some lives start in abject chaos, and it makes life so much harder for them. How we are supposed to begin and tended to is in a life of order through some group that gives us this order. For most of us, it's going to be a family. But it's also stretched out to different teams, schools, sports. For many people, it's the military, where there is an order. We have a group and there are boundaries. We know who is in the group and who is outside of the group. The group offers their perspective on how the world is supposed to be. And how life comes together, so we know what is right and what is wrong. And we are given this initial order. If you would, it's the seed. It's the seed that is in the womb of the earth. When the seed is in the womb, things are warm, they are right, and they are establishing their roots in order for stability for later on. Walter Brueggemann, one of my favorite biblical scholars, talks about the Hebrew scriptures and how they emulate and demonstrate human development. And it begins with law. Israel needed to know who they were after they were released from captivity out of Egypt. They didn't know who they were, and so they sent Moses right on up the mountain, did God, to give him the law, to establish where the boundaries were, to know what is right and what is wrong, to give the perspective on life. That is where life is to begin in order. This is a beautiful and necessary time. It is a time of innocence. It is a time of safety. And as Moses went up the mountain, I want to show you this through Jesus a little bit. In Matthew chapter 5, we remember that Matthew is writing to an audience that was primarily Jewish, and so this point wouldn't have missed. It would have been an exclamation point. In Matthew chapter 5, as Jesus begins his massive rendition, his interpretation, his fulfillment of the law, Jesus did not come to obliterate the law. He came to fulfill it, okay? Matthew records it this way. When Jesus saw the crowd, he went up the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him, and he began to speak, and he taught them, saying, "Blessed are the." The point would not have been missed. The law was given on a mountain. The initial framework, the order, was given on a mountain. Jesus is here redoing that, as Matthew's making this extraordinary point. He went up the mountain to fulfill exactly what this law was to be all about. He didn't come to abolish it. He came to fulfill it. I've been graced with several experiences of order, my family, different teams, etc. But probably the greatest of these was the summer camp that I worked at in college called Sunshine Ministries. It was my true order experience. Man, we were counselors living on those houseboats, dealing with youth groups coming in. Our staff was tight. We knew what our mission was, and we felt like we could change the world. And in many ways, we were marching out on into that. We see it in Paul's life. He received his group's order, which was the Israelite people. Remember this, what he says in Philippians chapter 3? He says it like this: "Man, if anybody had reason to be confident in the flesh, I have more. Circumcised on the eighth day, member of the people of Israel, tribe of Benjamin, Hebrew born of Hebrews, as to the law, Pharisee, as to zeal, persecuted the church, as to righteousness, as to the law, blameless." I had everything. I received my order perfectly. I did exactly what they wanted me to do. I absorb this whole boundary system in which they gave me. And it's the place in which we are introduced to Paul in the New Testament scriptures. In the book of Acts, we see Paul first as he presides over the martyr of Stephen. He's presiding over the martyr of Stephen because he's received his order, yet something else is coming, bumping up against him, and he's not able to make sense of it. He's living inside of his perspective, which is all we have when we are in original order. We have the perspective that those who gave it to us, and they probably gave us a larger perspective, but when we are in that phase, we can only see a narrow slice of it. We can only see a narrow slice of our own perspective when we are inside of the original order that we were given. And so when people started talking about this Jesus, who is outside of his perspective of how the Messiah was supposed to be, he couldn't handle it. It didn't match up with his order. He was given an order of what the Messiah was supposed to look like and what the Messiah was supposed to do, and it was bumping up against him because it was outside of his original container. So he had no concept for how to deal with it, and he starts doing what people do. When you're in your original order, you have your way and your perspective of seeing things, and reality starts bumping up against you that doesn't fit into your perspective. He tried to stamp theirs out. Let me give you an example. When I was a kid growing up in California, the suburbs, wealthy suburbs of the San Francisco Bay Area, I heard multiple times, never directly taught, but definitely overheard and caught, Mexican people are lazy. That was part of the ethos of the 1980s in the San Francisco Bay Area. That's what came to me. That's what came to me. And you know what? When I was a kid, I believed it. Because I didn't know any Mexicans when I was a kid. I just heard stories about them and jumping over the borders and all this. And then you go with your church on a mission trip. And you're down there building some building right outside of Tijuana. And guess what? Their work ethic buried mine. They worked harder, longer, stronger than any man I had ever met. And it didn't fit in the system that I was given, in the ordered system. And so I had to make sense of this new reality. And that's what's happening to Paul. Is he starting to make sense of this, or is he not being able to make sense of it? For all of us, when we start to bump into pieces of reality that don't fit inside of our original order because we received it as we were young and we only had the capacity for a certain amount of perspective, we run into the second phase, which is called disorder. Paul starts to hit his disorder when he's dealing with this whole Jesus movement. Things are happening, people are calling it this Messiah thing, and he's now in disorder because it doesn't fit what he thought would fit. And we see it in his life. It's coming out. His response is to attempt to stamp it out. Something different than his order is bumping against him, and he doesn't quite yet know what to do with it because he doesn't have the humility of the years to be able to say, this doesn't fit into how I understand the world. My group's particular perspective, but my particular group can't see everything. Maybe I've got something to learn here. Maybe they see something that I don't see. Disorder is when we start to see that our ordered perspective is somehow incomplete. You know, beginning to experience this disorder, this anxiety, this tension, because the world doesn't match our order. We see it in the life of Peter. Okay, Peter's order came about when Jesus called him off of that fishing boat. He said, come follow me, I'll make you fisher of men. That's what I'm going to do. He adopted that order wholesale. And Jesus was attempting to teach him with direct teachings about what that meant to follow him and become a fisher of people. He taught him directly, I must suffer and I must die. But because Peter's perspective, living inside that original order, was still so narrow, he couldn't accept that suffering and pain and what he thought looked like losing was a part of the perspective. So each time Jesus brings up this concept of suffering, being turned over to the elders and being crucified, he keeps pushing it back on him. And when they came to pick him up, he drew his sword. No! This isn't reality. This doesn't fit my world and how things are supposed to be. He started entering that tension of disorder and didn't quite know what to do with it or how to handle it, but it comes crashing all the way down. You remember when he thought in his mind, we're going to do this, we're going to fight this battle, and we're going to win. Jesus, I will never deny you, ever. I will go to the grave, I'll go to prison with you, no matter what, I'm sticking with it. And that very night after he shared communion with his Lord, three times he denied him. His whole system crumbled to the ground. This wasn't what I thought it was. His whole entire sense of order crumbled to the ground. It crumbled all the way to the ground. He didn't know what to do. His reality did not fit. You know, usually we don't jump into the disorder phase of human development that helps us have hearts shaped like Jesus because we're allowing the roots to do their work. On that road to Damascus, Paul found his. He was struck by a light that left him blind. He was going to persecute the church. This exists outside of my order, how I see the world. I'm going to stamp it out right now. That's what I'm going to do. And in perfect poetry, the man who thought he could see everything with clarity and certitude can now see nothing. How brilliant are the scriptures. The man who thought he could see everything now can see nothing. He is struck blind by a light. And he has to live inside of that tension of not being able to see. He thought he could see everything, and now he's inside of this time of tension where he's not able to see anything. We have an order, and we bump into reality that speaks to our limited perspective. We all have some plan A, and we normally don't jump into plan B. Almost never do we. We have this thought, if I live like this, this is what will come about in life. This is what will show up. We're normally thrust inside of disorder. We don't go willingly choosing to be there. It's usually some sort of untimely death. It's usually some sort of addiction that we can't seem to shake. I thought if I did these things, this would happen. I thought I would be free by now. I gave my life to working for this company, spent the best years, some of the most creativity, and this is how they respond to me? Letting me go in my mid-50s? Where's the fairness? And all of a sudden, reality is not matching up to our life experience, and we are thrust like Jonah off the boat. They threw him off the boat. He didn't jump off the boat. We're usually thrust into this time of disorder. Something jolts us into it. It's not... It's a natural and necessary part of the development. And without taking this part of joy's ride, our fruit doesn't get developed. Brueggemann continues his analysis of the scriptures paralleling human development by saying, first we need the law, then we need the prophets. First we need the law, the order, then we need the prophets, something to shake that up to get us outside of our disorder. Prophets are the ones who love us enough in order to criticize us. That's usually life, but that's what it comes to in the sense of the prophets. They're the ones who love us enough to criticize us. And I just have to make this parenthetical comment. You know who a true prophet is. You know undeniably who a true prophet is because it costs them more to give you the message than it costs you to receive the message. There are many who will come to you intending to say that they are prophets. You need to change this and you're doing this wrong and blah, blah, blah. I've had 1,000 of them in my lifetime. But the truth of every prophet in the Holy Scriptures is that it costs them way more to give that message than it ever cost the people to receive it. Think Hosea. Mary, an unfaithful woman? Think John the Baptist. Live in the wilderness on bugs? Go to jail? Be beheaded? This how it ends? Cost that man way more than it ever cost any of those people listening to his chastisements. The true prophet is the one who absorbs the cost at a greater level than it is for you to receive it. You can take that to the bank and let that person know who's trying to be the prophet in your life the next time that they do that. It's true. Okay, well, disorder is miserable. The second phase is miserable for everybody. It's a miserable stage. And as Jesus is offering his fulfillment of the law up on the mountain, reinterpreting the fulfillment of the law. He teaches us directly what it is to be blessed. We all want joy. We're all targeting that direction. Jesus teaches us directly what it is, and he's teaching us this pattern right here. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. He's talking about the internal work that needs to get done. If you look at each of those first three elements, which are given on the front end of the thing, absolutely on purpose, you have to go through this disorder, this internal working of becoming, identifying with the poor in the spirit, being able to mourn the necessary grief that every single one of us goes through, being able to be meek, that is, receive the power that you have, but don't lord it over other people. We're given power, but not to control others. We're given power in order to bless the community, to work for the greater good. He gives those first three on purpose. That internal work that we have to do and get to in the realm of disorder. In the realm of disorder, Jesus starts with those things. Poor in spirit, being mournful, and being meek. Jesus knows unless we go through this necessary disorder, we won't experience actual blessedness. It'll be us trying to receive joy from the outside. Jesus is calling out these first three states of blessedness, and there is a necessary humility to receive those things. To enter into this state of disorder, this tension, this Paul seeing Jesus, things going away, this Peter in his own shame after he is denied Jesus. Our Western version of Christianity that each one of us has received to certain degrees and the other, we don't know how to honor the disorder phase. We're terrible at it. When people are in disorder and their world crashes down, all we want to do is rush them right through as fast as we can. We don't honor this phase of the process very well on this soil, right? We have pithy phrases. We don't feel comfortable with their tension, and we don't trust that it can teach them anything or carry them to a new place. And so we try to rush people through it. This is the phase where the seed, the roots are now getting established, and the seed just starts to poke its head up above. And it's hot out here, and it's windy, and there are predators that will kill me. And I am but a young and vulnerable little plant sticking my head up above the ground for the first time. And it's disorienting. Can you imagine what's going through the seed's mind at that point? Everything changed. Everything changed. And I don't know what to make of it right now. Because I want you to think of it this way. You know, if you were given the responsibility to train a Jedi Knight, what would you do? You know what you'd do? You'd bring him to that state-of-the-art scientific place where he's running on the treadmill with the thing attached to his mouth, and there's scientists figuring it out, and samurais out there teaching him how to, I don't know. Luke goes to the swamp in the Dagobah system. Last time I saw Empire Strikes Back, which was Wednesday, because Heather was at Bible study, and I was like, I haven't seen this for a while. I'm going to watch it. Struck with the brilliance of this moment. Swamps are things to be avoided. But he goes there to learn the ultimate lessons. When he shows up on the swamp-infested planet and his transportation in order to get to the next one is stalled, stuck in the swamp, in a moment of screenwriting brilliance, Luke says to Yoda, remember he's interacting with Yoda, and he doesn't recognize the teacher. Because in disorder, you don't recognize the teacher at first. He says to Yoda, I'm looking for a mighty warrior, because that's who's going to teach me how to get to the next level. Not you, frog, turtle, man, whatever you are. Clearly, you don't got nothing for me. This is disorder. We're not able to get to the next phase because our transportation is shut down. and we can't recognize the master teacher that is disorder right in front of us. And everything in our culture is trying to just push us through it. Instead of being able to sit in that tension and absorb what it is that God has for us there. It's why Jesus follows the first three Beatitudes with a call to stick with it. Blessed are those who are hungry and thirsty for righteousness, for they will be filled. He knows when you're in the swamp, all you're going to want to do is get out of the swamp. So stick with it. You got to hold on, baby. You got to stay hungry. You got to stick with the process. You got to trust that Yoda is the teacher. You got to hang on to where it is. We're in that place of anxiety when all we want to do is numb it and escape it. And maybe start running back to our original order. It was better back over here, but I can't seem to get out of here, so I'll just start numbing myself with my given means to do that. It's what Paul calls the foolishness of the cross. This is ridiculous. What are we doing here? It's why Paul says the foolish things of the world will shame the wise. The cross looks like idiocracy to the rest of the world. The holy cross, though, of Friday is what begins the transformation. The holy cross of Friday, which gives birth to the holy hell of Saturday, which then ultimately leads to the holy resurrection of Sunday. Paul humbly received his blindness, his period, his time, where one who thought he could see everything but now can see nothing. He received the humbling and the necessary adjustments to his original order and began his life of reorder. We begin in order. We struggle through the holy cross and the holy hell of Saturday's disorder and move on to the reorder of the resurrection in this internal process that produces the fruit of joy. Reorder is the joy of Sunday's resurrection. It's life on the other side of death, the sense of renewal. We've been there, right? Where you just bawl and you finally wipe your face of the tears and the snot and you feel like you had a couple of energy drinks or something. We know now that there are toxins that get flushed out in our tears. We're renewed after we engage. That's a small little snippet of what that disorder looks like when we begin to cry and allow the feelings out and we are mourned and find that somehow there's a comfort within it. We see that Yoda is the master. We see that we start to say some crazy things, and you hear people say these things, and I pray that more of us continue to say them. You know, when I lost them, when the job fell through, when I raised my kids to walk with the Lord and they all walked away, I thought it was over. But now I see that was Yoda. That was the great teacher in my life that grew me up and brought me to another place. And this is the catchphrase. And I wouldn't change it because it's what brought me to this new place of freedom. You can't have a resurrection without a crucifixion. You can't do it. There isn't a way for that to happen. Brueggemann finishes his analysis of the Old Testament scriptures by saying it's first its law, then its prophets, then its wisdom. The book of wisdom comes to us at the great and heavy price of our innocence and our control. If we're trying to maintain that original innocence, if we're trying to maintain that order, that original control, we'll never get to wisdom. We just simply won't get there. Jesus turns the corner on the Sermon on the Mount and shows us that the blessed ones, the fruit of those who are engaging the initial humbling work of disorder, which are the things that we now are able to do, the things that deal with other people. We're able to deal, he says, blessed are the merciful, blessed are the pure in heart, for they'll see God, and blessed are the peacemakers, because they'll be children of God. Those are all three things, after you've hung on through the time of disorder, that we start to then deal with other people. Most of our misery comes through our own arrogance of only thinking about ourselves, either on how great we think we are, right? And judging other people all day long, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. Or how terrible we think we are, which is pride's backdoor entrance into our life. I'm so miserable. No human of all 7 billion of them have a story like mine, right? Like, how arrogant is that? Pride sneaks in and starts to steal us of that so that we're only thinking of ourselves. Once we've crossed through this valley of disorder, we start to deal with other people and become the merciful ones. And those who are pure in heart, who are able to see God. And where's God? The pure in heart see God everywhere. And we're able to become the peacemakers that God desired for us to be. This is what is called in reorder the second naivete. Jesus regularly uses the image of a child and even goes so far in Mark to say, if you don't enter the kingdom like a child, you don't enter. You're not getting in there unless you adopt this sort of second naivete. It's a mature naivete. It's a renewed innocence. I know this world is a mess, but somehow God will wipe these tears. I've experienced it. Somehow God will renew all of these things. It's within his powers. I'm not sure exactly how all this will work, but the worst things turn out to the best things. We start to trust the fact that in the hands of God, the ingredients of the muck of our lives becomes the tools that God uses to bring us to that state of reorder and start producing that tasty fruit of joy to the world. Each day has its own beauty and cannot be skipped. What we want to do is take a direct flight from order to reorder. But y'all have to take a layover in disorder. And you have to sit on the tarmac. And there's no communication coming through. And you're just going to be frustrated and angry because you feel like you need to be going somewhere, but the plane's not going to get off the ground. Until that stage is engaged. Until Luke can see you, Yoda, are the master teacher because you do have power. And you're going to bring me to that new place. Order, disorder, reorder. It's the internal process. It's the internal method. It's the gospel. It's the good news of what produces fruit. Often there's a major moment that brings us from order to disorder. But you never stop making that trip. What you do is get better at spotting it. Ah, there's Yoda. Come on over here. Teach me up. Let's do this. You never stop doing those crucifixions, those Saturdays, those resurrections. We never stop doing those, but usually there's a large one that we confront and we're able to move through. And we're able to embrace much more quickly. Church, I believe this. Last week, I think we had one of the most powerful sermons ever preached at Council Tree. The collective groan. Dale Lusk, a supportive missionary of our church who works for our denomination, has done miracles for our denomination over the last 25 years. He told us the story of a miracle happening in McAllen, Texas. For those of you who are here, remember, I'm sure. He said that he was called in to preach at the Covenant Church that is there. Covenant Church consisted of about 15 white people who were 75 and better. It was a church that grew up in a neighborhood that had become predominantly Latino and had zero idea how to adjust what it was doing. And so it was basically 17 people waiting to die, and then they closed the church. The denomination even came in and said, we need to shut this one down. Until one day, Dale went and preached there. And in the back row, ironically, there was this 19-year-old Latino kid who Dale was like, what in the world are you doing here? And the kid said, I've never been to church before in my life. I moved in right across the street, and something in me just said, I should go to church, so I'm here at church. Dale takes him to lunch, and the guy, and he says, well, what'd you think? And he goes, well, it was awesome, the most riveting thing I've ever been a part of. And Dale was like, nope, that church service was trash. And I preached, And at the following week, the guy brings back six people, and the denomination spots what's going on, and they send somebody in to start discipling and mentoring those people. Dale gets a call a little while later and says, Dale, we need help with the children's ministry. We got one kid. Dale shows up, and through another course of series of miracles, all of a sudden they have this children's ministry within about a three-week period of 25 kids. And today, 2 years later, that church is a healthy, thriving intercultural, very broad, multi-ethnic church. I never thought that it could be. God's doing a miracle there. It's really exciting. And here's the thing Dale didn't tell you about that story that I got to hear because I was on the phone with him. Because we think the miracle is with the 19-year-old. We think the miracle is with those families that started to bring their kids, with the denomination that started helping out on the deal. And he told me this part of the story, and I wish he would have told it, so I'm going to just tell it. He said a year before any of this happened, and one of those people who was a widow and rather wealthy, she died. And she was a person of second innocence. She was a person of naivete. And in her will, she gifted that church with $250,000, knowing full well it was on the trail to death. And she said in her note, "I'm giving this money to this church because I believe God wants to do miracles here. I believe God wants to do miracles at this place," having no idea what it would look like. Having no concept, exactly like those sitting in the upper room on that first Pentecost. What are we waiting for? What's this even look like when it gets here? No idea, but we got to lean in anyway. Church, the miracle is in our staying with it, in that place, and emerging out on the other side, and able to produce the great fruit of joy, for this is joy's ride. Praise be to God.